You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
First of all, I would like to congratulate one of my former players who became president of Liberia, George Weah. It's not often that you have a former player who becomes president of a country. So well done, Georgie.
Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger commits the Premier League's own Dewey defeats Truman moment by prematurely congratulating George Weah on becoming president of Liberia. My guests Daniel Giacopelli, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Edwards will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including a somewhat nervous look ahead to Austria's election, a long-awaited answer to humankind's anguished clamour for a low-fat avocado, and a leaf through the latest edition of Monocle magazine. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Daniel Giacopelli and Tom Edwards. Welcome all. We will start in Austria, which votes in parliamentary elections on Sunday. This is attracting more international attention than Austrian elections usually do, which is to say that it's attracting any at all, during to lingering nervousness about the far-right populism presently at large on the continent. Current polls suggest that the unsavoury cranks of the Freedom Party might have been headed off by the Conservative People's Party, and that the People's Party's leader, 31-year-old Sebastian Kurz, might be the next chancellor. Danny, first of all, immigration, surprisingly, has again been the dominant issue. Why, in Austria's case?
Well, I think it's become the issue in most of the parties, because basically they wanted to be exempt from this plan to put 160,000 asylum seekers throughout Europe into, you know, into Europe and then thus into Austria. And they had basically told the EU that they already fulfilled their obligation to take in more. And then from that, all this negative public attention kind of seeped into all of the talk amongst the parties. And that like kind of the national consciousness became aware that like this should be a big issue.
Fernando, conventional wisdom in Austria, at least, already has it that Kurz is winning by, or appears to be winning anyway, by taking while what is a hard line on immigration is not quite as hard a line on immigration as the Freedom Party. Is there, are we learning here the somewhat depressing lesson that the only way to let the air out of populist movements is to give in to them to a certain extent?
But in my opinion, that's not the only reason why he's doing so well. I think we should also remember that he, you know, he's a very charismatic, handsome 31-year-old man, and I think, you know, some articles were wrongly said, in my opinion, saying that he would be the new Macron or Trudeau of Austria. Clearly not, because, you know, he's from a different political spectrum. But I think this charisma injected some excitement among Austrian voters who are used, let's remember that 44 out of the 70 years, you know, it was like a coalition between the main parties. So I think our Austrians are a bit bored of that. I think maybe they want a little bit of excitement as well.
Tom, a charismatic Austrian politician running on an outsider ticket, what could possibly go wrong, and so forth?
Now, Andrew.
The downside here, and it is not a small downside, is depending on how it shakes out over the weekend, the Freedom Party might actually end up in government. Hmm. This has happened before when they were led by Jörg Haider, the unlamented, but those were different times. That seemed at the time a kind of strange, freakish outlier result, whereas now is it starting to look like a new normal?
To a degree. I mean, it's definitely instructive to compare the early 2000s with now and to look at how this narrative, as Fernando correctly said, is something that we constantly come back to, whether we're looking at in France or in the Netherlands or in Germany or again here in Austria. Of course, it's a worry if not only do you get political responsibility directly passing to far-right parties.
Far-right is, of course, the extremely polite way of describing
these
people.
Quite. But I think, you know, to your point earlier about is the only way to silence populist voices by if not aping them, but shifting their direction. I mean, you are seeing that to a degree. I think the critical thing, and I spoke on this program a few weeks ago to Quentin Peel, one of our regular contributors, and he was more sanguine about this idea of a whole shift to the right, you know, across national divides and across political divides. And what he was saying was that these elements, these social and political elements, have always been there, certainly if we go back probably to, say, you know, post-1945. And the challenge for Western liberal democracies isn't to ensure that they're silenced altogether or that they're marginalised or that they're sent underground or whatever it might be, but just that it's managed. And I think provided that groups like the Freedom Party, I don't know, maybe even get a chance to show how bad they are at the game of politics, it could be no bad thing.
This is a thing that does come up, of course, quite frequently when you get populist blowhards who've generally campaigned or taken a fairly simplistic view of an extremely complicated issue, and then you tell them to make sure that the rubbish gets collected once a week and water comes out of the taps. They tend to be more or less entirely useless. But Danny, is there still a disconnect here between European politicians and European electorates, in that whether or not you think people's reservations about immigration are wrong or right, are they dealing sufficiently or correctly with the fact that quite a lot of people clearly just don't like it?
Quite a lot of people don't like what? Elitists or populism?
Immigration. There are, of course, I think at this table, it's 75% coming over here and presenting all your radio programs versus one local.
But Andrew, is that even what people are really angry about?
And I think this is.
But this was a narrative around Brexit. That's what they said they were angry about.
I'm pretty sure that's what they were angry about.
But then they vote for something that's entirely self-defeating, where the very people who are going to be most profoundly effective in a negative way are those same people. They're angry about their lot and they're blaming migrants.
But that's because these votes and these sentiments are emotional, atavistic and reactive. They're not thought through at all. It's entirely sentimental.
It's bigger than immigration. It's more kind of the new globalized world we're living in, where jobs are growing overseas, everything's getting shifted by technology, and the public face that you see when you walk around every day is the other, and that's what you take out your anger on, because they kind of represent this new world we're living in.
And if I may add something as well, I think we're forgetting, you know, the main party in Austria, at least at the moment, with 26%, are the Social Democrats. Indeed. And the reason why they're not doing so well in this election, it hasn't been reported that much. One of their advisors ran a fake campaign saying that, Kurz is an anti-Semitic. And this was found, and that advisor, you know, I believe he was arrested. And of course, this damaged a lot the Social Democrats. So I wonder if the Austrians have a little bit of a lack of option as well.
There's one other important thing, which actually Fernando alluded to earlier, and that's that Kurz himself is a charismatic younger politician. I maintain that if we had politicians who were of a better standard, frankly, better orators, more charismatic, who made a more compelling case about whatever their ideology, if we had more of those from anywhere closer to the centre, on the right or the left, you'd quickly see a diminishing impact from people on the margins.
Well, let us transition seamlessly now from an election which will happen to an election which has. Liberians voted last weekend in a parliamentary and presidential election, the headline result of which would be the choosing of a successor to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, stepping down after two terms and one Nobel Prize. Counting thus far appears to be favouring George Weah, attempting to become the first person to win both FIFA World Player of the Year and a presidential election. Fernando, first of all, should the world have learned something about celebrity politicians in the last year or so? Like, you know, don't.
Well, yeah. To be honest, I think there are different types of celebrity. You know,
George Weah has been demonstrably very good at something in his life.
Well, and from what I've read, about his life, he was a humanitarian guy. You know, he had some sort of involvement in politics in the country. So it was not just like, cool, I play very good football and I want to be president of my country. And I don't know. I have nothing against him, and I think that's completely fine.
Tom, what do we think about the ideas of footballers turning politician? Does it happen often in Britain? It doesn't really, does it?
There aren't that many tremendous success stories. And actually, Fernando's motherland boasts a couple who've tried. Pele, one of the greatest of all time, not a brilliant politician. No. Romario, he's having a bash now.
What did Pele try? Wasn't he the culture minister at some
point? He used to be the sports minister in the 90s. and actually, Romario, one of our best players ever, he's current the senator in Rio. And to be honest, he so far he's not involved in the Operation Car Wash. I think that's good enough.
So far's doing a lot of work.
That's good enough for Brazil.
I mean, Andrew, I did want to jump in on that point about celebrity. I think to describe George Weah as a celebrity is slightly unfair. I know you were alluding to our orange friend in the White House, but Weah was not just an amazing footballer,
which he was,
and he tried to raise the cause of Liberia both as a sporting cause and a political one. He bankrolled the team himself once he became established. As Fred said, he's been a humanitarian advocate and activist, and he's done everything by the book. And he's not just said, oh, I fancy a go at this. He ran for the presidency in 2005. He ran again as a vice presidential candidate, I think, 6 or 7 years later. And he's been in the Senate for the last 3 years. So he's a man of serious political conviction, and he's a man of serious achievement over 20 years more. And I think we shouldn't hold that against him, even though apparently Arsene Wenger calls him Georgie, which is the most disturbing thing I've learned so far today.
There are examples from my own homeland you will all be enthralled to learn. Brian Dixon, during the 60s, not only played Australian rules football for Melbourne, but at the same time was a member of Victoria's Parliament. And Ray Groom, who also played for Melbourne at around that time, went on to become Premier of Tasmania.
Wait, so the first one played football and was a politician?
Yeah, he used to play football Saturdays for Melbourne and was a Victorian state legislator during the week.
Did he change his singlet on the way to parliamentary meetings?
I really hope not. It's deviating slightly from the template, but Peter McKenna, the great Collingwood full forward of the late 60s and early 70s, recently sought employment as an official ministerial driver for the Victorian Parliament. Danny, do American footballers often go, like NFL players go into politics? Well, I mean, famously...
soccer players in America?
Famously, Lyndon Johnson said of Gerald Ford that his problem was that he'd played football too long without a helmet.
I mean, listen, if Michael Jordan decided one day to run for Senate, he'd probably win. Let's put it that way.
LeBron James on current form.
LeBron James would make an excellent politician. I mean,
well, there's an irony, is there not, that
Tom Brady,
some of the most effective political opposition in the United States to Trump at the moment is coming from current sportsmen. And who knew how eloquent some of these guys were? And everyone laughs at them and says, "Oh, you know, they're roided up freaks battering the living daylights out of one another."
They're more eloquent than Trump when they come out.
But they were absolutely.
Danny, can you name three people or indeed things that aren't more eloquent than Trump?
Well, that's true. But, I mean, really, when these people have been interviewed in the locker room, it's like, oh, my God, they should run for politics.
I'm telling you, it comes back to what I said earlier about lack of good candidates. I think as soon as you go into politics, it somehow negatively affects your ability to express yourself. These people are better off staying on the outside of the game.
There's even the beautiful story of a football player, Socrates, you know, Hinton, that, you know, he was very much an anti-dictatorship campaigner in Brazil. And, you know, he was on the Brazilian thing at the time. And it was very rare to have people come out and speak against the dictatorship, but he did it. So I do believe in the political power of those great sportsmen.
And he was another polymath, because he was a doctor, of course, as well.
Yeah, he was also a doctor.
What a
and
man.
Of course, we're talking about John Glenn, famous astronaut. He became a politician. I'm trying to think of other people who are kind of physically involved in a world other than sports.
There's been a couple of other NFL players. Wasn't Kemp, Senator Kemp, Jack Kemp, I think.
That is a person.
Played for the New York Giants. I think I'm remembering
far
that
far beyond my knowledge.
I could be entirely
Al
wrong.
Al Franken,
about.
Famous comedian.
Indeed. But Danny, are you surprised, looking at America, how much political currency that NFL players, especially this year, have been able to attract? Not just Colin Kaepernick, but of course many, many others.
Am I surprised that they've been gotten their word out as much as they have?
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, these are some of the most highly paid, famous people in the country. Why shouldn't they have a say in what goes on in the country?
Well, asking the same question from the opposite direction, Tom, does it strike you as weird that we don't hear more attempts to involve themselves in the public discourse from football players in this country? I mean, it's often jokingly said that Gary Lineker has become the de facto leader of the opposition in this country, but of course he hasn't played for some considerable time.
Yeah, I think the trouble is that in recent memory, certainly, footballers tend to fall foul of getting involved in political pronouncements. And any time they've been taken off message, as it were, they've been tripped up by the press. I think the key difference, I think, in the US is how many of these sports are dominated by black athletes. And, you know, and again, although Trump and his ilk are painting it as an anti-American protest, which sounds like something from the kind of McCarthy era, it wasn't. It was a protest about black rights in America. And if you've got sports like the NFL or the NBA, where we're talking about a lot of these athletes plying their trade, which are sort of 80-90% black, to those athletes, they're using their profile to get out a message which is of the most profound personal importance. I don't think there's been an issue in this country that interests or affects the kind of sporting class in quite the same way.
I mean, again, just thinking of Australia, which is still roiled in this absurd plebiscite the country is insisting on having about same-sex marriage. Both the Australian Football League and the National Rugby League as institutions have come out, no pun intended, as in favour of a yes vote, and they've been quite explicit about it. I mean, is there a similar... Is there any kind of, like, you mentioned Socrates there, but beyond the occasional individual, is there a tradition in Brazil of sport having a social conscience?
Well, not really, actually. Definitely not like what happened in Australia. Although, you know, it's very common, for example, in the city of Belo Horizonte in Brazil, the top, you know, the mayor and the second most voted as a mayor, they were both involved, they were president of clubs in the region. So, you know, there's a huge association between football and politics. But not very much in the ideological sense, more in the money sense of the word.
And of course, we forgot about Bill Bradley, U.S. Senator, former basketball player. He was on the New York Knicks. He was a senator from 1979 to 97. Incredibly famous guy. He was a Rhodes Scholar, too, so that's probably a bit of an exception. Really smart guy.
And presumably very tall.
Very, very tall, Bill Bradley. He now hosts a radio show. Andrew, maybe you have a career in...
I could go the other way.
Into
professional basketball. I think that ship may have sailed. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Mullett, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Daniel Giacopelli, and Tom Edwards. Coming up next, diet avocados, which are apparently a thing.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Daniel Giacopelli, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Tom Edwards. Now, it may seem to the passing listener that the development of a lower-calorie avocado was not among the top 10 million or so most pressing issues presently confronting humanity. Nevertheless, a Spanish company has gone ahead and addressed it. The Isla Bonita brand of Eurobanan has bred an avocado which, it is claimed, has a third of the fat of the average. And yes, since you're asking, it is quite a slow news day. Danny, how excited are you by the diet avocado? What change do you imagine this will make to your life?
Well, I'm not excited at all because it's only going to be sold to Spaniards, of which I'm not one.
That's taking a very narrow view.
And maybe, Danny, if I move to Spain and get into the culinary arts, I'll be excited. But as a Londoner, it'll have no effect on my life. And I don't actually like its existence either, because I hate when you just take a perfectly good food and make it a diet version of itself.
Well,
there's no need for that.
On the subject of hate, Fernando, I understand...
But I love avocados, Fernando.
Well, see, this is where this could get controversial, because, Fernando, I understand that not only do you dislike avocados, you are, in fact, a member of an online hate group.
I am indeed. Me and other 287 very clever people, apparently.
Outed on Midori House. Yeah.
No, tell us more about this unsavory, sinister forum to which you contribute.
The robes are off.
No, you know, it's almost, there's a touch of comedy to it, you know.
But there's nothing funny about hate.
No, that's what they all say, Fernando. That's how it starts. We were just getting together in this beer hall in Munich for a bit of a laugh on Sunday afternoons, and it all got out of hand.
Because we make fun of this of people's obsession with avocado. And can I tell the story how I found this? I was at a party.
Please, please, confess everything.
I was at a party and we were offered an avocado cake as dessert. And, you know, I just can't eat avocados. I literally hated the thing. But it was a good friend of mine. I just said, oh, sorry, I'm feeling full. So I think I said, you know, she was sitting close to me. I said, oh my God, I hate avocados. She was like, oh my God, me too. I actually have a community online. And then she was from Queensland, by the way.
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
So,
what's an avocado cake?
They're all a bit strange up there.
I wouldn't like that either. I love avocados.
It was very mushy and it was very bad pastry. I hope my friend is not listening to this, but it was not very good. But but to be honest, I don't like the texture of the fruit. And I was bothered when I moved to the UK how avocados literally everywhere. Not in Brazil.
Does this group or community, as you insist on calling it, have a kind of, is there a military wing?
No. But can I say something even worse? If avocados are terrible, diet avocados are even worse. I agree with you.
Well,
avocados
are healthy. It's good fat. So why would you want to take away the fat? Literally, it's like olive oil. It's good fat. It's good for your body.
I did want to ride in on this one point. This is a classic example of a phenomenon I've developed here as a result of the same phenomenon which I've received from colleagues, which is non-help. This doesn't need help. We didn't need a diet. It's good fat. You're taking away.
There are several levels of redundancy here.
There's nothing left.
Because apart from that, they're also doing the incredibly irritating thing, judging by the advertising material, of putting some sort of packaging on it.
But the marketing.
I mean, fruit has packaging. It comes with its own.
Is it being called Slim Cardo?
Oh, I hope
not.
Oh,
God. The marketing, it's from Eurobanan, a Spanish company. It's advertising it as ideal for the preparation of smoothies, cold soup, gazpachos, cocktails, and many other dishes throughout the day.
See, a friend of mine swears blind. He once saw oranges wrapped in cardboard wrappers which had written on them citrus snack solution.
But at the same time, I hope
that's true.
At the same time, I might be a little bit hypocrite here because I'm criticizing diet avocados, but for example, I would buy watermelon without seeds, for example. You know, so do you know what I mean? Like,
that's just depraved.
But as a testament to Fernando's diet, can we also say he's an avid Red Bull drinker?
Oh, yeah.
I fear that.
So I don't know if we're getting the best
I fear that
diet
we,
advice.
We
here.
Are deviating somewhat from the point. Tom, is it weird and unfair? Weird and or unfair that the avocado has become stigmatized, I think, as an emblem of middle class self-indulgence and general milk toastery, if you were. It became a thing early this year when some Australian property baron hit back at people complaining that it was too expensive to buy anywhere to live in Australia by suggesting that if today's young folk spent less money on avocado toast, they might be able to afford a house.
I was infuriated. You
would have to give up a lot of avocado toast to be able to buy a house in Australia.
I was infuriated by this. The avocado is one of the great food items of the world. I don't know if this stands true of the new slimmed down version. It's the only thing you can eat without impediment. Just that, and you can stay alive.
I agree.
It's a complete food source. You probably might go a bit green, but you can survive. Maybe not if it's a slimmed down version.
What's the longest you've ever survived in the wilderness on an all avocado diet?
Well, you could be there. There's probably people still who took a bet like that, Andrew, and are still out roaming healthily through the wilds right now. I don't understand why it's been demonized in this way.
Well, because it's like, oh, those latte sipping liberals. It's in that kind of camp of just
why.
Like,
yeah, but why the avocado?
Well, because they're expensive over here. I mean, in California, they're not expensive because that's where they're grown. They also take a lot of water. It's not very environmentally friendly to make these things, but they taste delicious.
Is any of this persuading you, Fernando?
Absolutely not. In fact, just thinking about it, I could only eat avocado my whole life. I don't know.
You might. What's the name of your anti-avocado lobby? Is it called Avocado No or something like that?
It's much better name. It's just called I Hate Avocado.
Please join us. You've missed a trick on that.
Please join us.
Is it known as IHA for short? Do you have an emblem on your berets?
It's a secret. I think I'm giving away too much.
Yeah.
We shall move along because finally there is, well, not say finally in terms of tonight's program, not finally as in it's 3 weeks later or anything, but there is a new issue of Monocle magazine on a newsstand near you now or very, very imminently. Let us now, gentlemen, pad out the running time of this show with an extended plug for it. This is our Swiss special.
And what a special thing. It is.
Tom's marketing voice kicks into gear right there.
No, I just think even look, we're fortunate. We get to watch the whole thing coming together. We get the finished copies before anyone else. It's just a delight. It's crammed with Swiss delicacies. And I should say, maybe we come back to this later. If you're actually in Switzerland,
yeah, this is pretty exciting.
There's a very, very special limited edition magazine. Maybe we'll return to that later. But why not? It's absolutely brilliant, and it's got a big old St. Bernard on the front. What's not to enjoy?
We stuff some fondue into page 30 when you open it up. It falls out. That's the special.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest when Tom said that it was crammed full of Swiss delicacies. Delicacies rather. I was going to insert a not literally. We could not wish to be clearer on that. Did we think about doing that? Do we maybe sort of having like a bag of chocolate stapled?
Well, like
to the
women's magazines have like perfume attached to the front.
Exactly.
Like
we could have sent each one out with a Toblerone or something.
No, that's far too.
Not the most compact of confectionery.
Though. Yeah, exactly.
No, it is not. Can you tell us a bit, Tom, seeing as how you actually have a copy there, a bit about what's in it?
Well, it's obviously the design special, and actually this speaks to this special edition which I was talking about, which is a for one country and one issue only redesign of the front cover of the magazine. It's sort of a Helvetica tribute to the design denizens of this great country. And it's amazing. It looks recognisably similar, but at once very, very different, which I guess is kind of the point. So there's an unashamed design bias. And it's really sort of just, dipping into how, I guess, a lot of people are familiar with it. You talk about Nordic countries, the sort of sensibility around great design or particular mood, whether it's in architecture or in retail or in almost in how people actually live their lives. And I think throughout the, I mean, it's, I don't know, 60 pages or more, it reflects on what that means. What is something that looks or feels uniquely Swiss, which has long been something that interests us. And I think anyone who's spent a lot of time there develops almost always an affinity with that. I mean, Danny goes quite often.
I'm always
what
in Switzerland.
What are you getting up to there? I don't know, but you spend a lot of time there and you like the place.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of good entrepreneurs there. There's a lot of interesting tech stories there for the entrepreneurs. I also used to live there when I was a student back in the day in Geneva. Not a good place for an 18-year-old with not a fat wallet.
Kind of, I was going to say, I bet you couldn't afford to buy any avocados.
Couldn't get into any clubs, had to kind of beg for food. No, I'm a fan of Switzerland.
And do you know what? I was very pleasantly surprised, actually, because my first partner was actually from Switzerland, from a small village called Poschiavo. And there is a little story. There's a pasta maker in the village of Poschiavo, which is, there's only about 1,000 people living there. You know, wow. It's very small. It's very close to Semmeritz. For those who don't know, you can take the Engadin train. So, very special. And
that is my favorite. Well, that vicinity is my favorite part of Switzerland. I did a story for Monocle's Alpino newspaper a few years ago in the lower Engadin Valley. You carry on going past Semmeritz. It's glorious. It's lovely. Except the trouble with traveling by train in Switzerland is you don't ever actually want to get off the trains.
Exactly.
I just want the people who run the Swiss railway network to be put in charge of absolutely everything. That's pretty much my one-size-fits-all solution.
I remember when I first started the Monocle, I went to Davos with Sam Impey, and we took a train, a night train to Davos, which is probably the most spectacular train ride you could possibly do. It's absolutely gorgeous. But then the kicker is Sam got off at the wrong stop. She got off at the wrong Davos. There's like a Davos before Davos, and she was just.
Why would you do that?
She was at Davos Cluster. She got off, and we were supposed to go to Davos. Anyway,
why would
she
you have off... two stations called the same? This has been bugging me for a week because last Wednesday I discovered, well, nearly a fortuitous train delay spared me. Discovered the hard way. Pro tip, everybody: there are two platform threes at Bologna Centrale.
Oh no, you need platform three.
Yeah. That was literally what they said. They said, no, you need platform three. It's like, mate, there's a big sign above us saying platform three. No, it was the other one.
To your point there, Andrew, about, if only Swiss railways ruled the world kind of thing. A lot of people, certainly in this country, said, what does post-Brexit Britain look like? who can we ape?
The complete opposite of Swiss
railways.
People
look and say, well, hang on, look, we could be like Switzerland. Not a chance. You couldn't even import one thousandth of
a low rent
Swiss
version.
Sensibility. It wouldn't even work for 5 minutes, tragically. Yeah.
Well, on that happy, optimistic note, a reminder that new edition of Monocle magazine, our Swiss special, containing also much stuff about things other than Switzerland. It's huge, actually. How many pages are in that?
302?
302. Good grief. On a newsstand very near you, very, very shortly, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli. Thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next. 1900, Marcos Hippie is here with the menu. There's more on the day's big stories on the daily at 2200, doubtless taking a long, hard look at Donald Trump's speech about matters Iranian. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.